Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We have four-time Indy 500 winner Rick Mears on this episode. Someone who, good Lord, been foundational aspect of my life in terms of following the Indy 500. Someone who's actually I was been alive for all four of his wins. Pretty amazing to think that Rick, who's still a pillar of the 500, I would say possibly the best man to ever lap that oval. I haven't seen everybody, obviously, but good Lord, if there's anybody better than Rick, I'd love to meet them. Thinking that back that we have 25 years of distance from Rick's last win, his fourth 500 win in 1991. So, we spent about 90 minutes on the phone. I'd originally planned for it to be about 15, and because Rick is awesome and generous with his time, we started talking about that 25th anniversary, meandered all over the place, driving for Roger Penske, mentoring young drivers, the introduction of data acquisition in his lifetime, the introduction of modern shock technology, something that we can credit his brother Roger for in off-road racing and bringing that into IndyCar racing, and now it's just commonplace everywhere. So Rick the Ruler, as we would call Slick Rick, Rick ruled the 500 during his window of opportunity, and good Lord, could have spoken with him for hours and hours and hours upon end. Hopefully you enjoy the 90 minutes we had covering a good portion of his incomparable career.
For me, I was just so fortunate, you know, to be able to get involved with Team Penske so early in my career.
Yeah.
You look at it now, it was early in his, but at that time it didn't seem early in his. You know, he'd been there for a while and already accomplished a heck of a lot and was already established as the team, you know, that everybody was wanting to be with. And he'd already kind of been setting the bar, but so, you know, when I got the opportunity, it was as much a surprise to me as anybody. You know, I was just starting out and had run for two small teams and was just trying to, you know, knocking on doors, trying to get something to open to, you know, hopefully a little bit later equipment. And after I missed the show in 77, the first year I tried, I remember sitting on the wall trying to console myself, you know, because Sugai was getting out of the business, and, you know, so I wasn't going to have a ride or anything. And I remember thinking, well, you know, maybe by next year, I'll have another year's experience under my belt and maybe a little bit newer, you know, later equipment or whatever, and, you know, maybe it'll be a little different outcome. Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
You never know. And little did I know that I'd be coming back next year with the best team in the business, you know. And so, I mean, going to Indy was way out of my league. You know, up till about 6 months before I actually got in a car, I'd never even thought about it because it was way out of my league.
Wow.
And I never dreamed of going to Indy. That was, you know, we raced for fun, and it was a hobby and family recreation, and never dreamed of making a living at it or anything else. It was just what, you know, we worked during the week to make the means to go play on the weekend and as a family recreation, and never dreamed of making it full-time. And then, you know, and about 6 months before I actually got in an IndyCar, I remember my brother and I sitting around thinking, wow, the way this is going, and, you know, opportunities kept popping up here and there, and offers to do this and do that in different forms of racing. And we saw how, man, you know, something could come of this if things keep going the way they are, you know. And I remember he and I talking about it, and that's about 6 months before I got in the car for IndyCar first time.
Wow.
And so I never really, and then after I got in IndyCars, you know, even up to the point of Roger offering me the opportunity, I never dreamed of being with Roger. You know, that was way out of my league. I still had a lot to learn and prove and, you know, everything else before I could get that kind of opportunity. So, like I say, it was as big a surprise to me as anybody when that opportunity came. And because we, you know, we'd only run for a season, you know, partially, you know, two different teams. And so it was really a surprise. And but it's just a blessing, you know, to get that opportunity that early. And then And then as it worked out, it was just, you know, we were a good fit, you know, with the team, and, you know, understanding the team concept that Roger operated under. You know, I didn't know it going in, but then as things took place, and, you know, I realized his team concept was basically what my brother and I had been doing all our lives. And I started realizing there were a lot of drivers out there that didn't understand the team concept and didn't want the team concept, because it was all about them, you know. And but I understood, because of what my brother and I did, that if we could help each other, you know, to raise our bar to another level, to get an advantage over everybody else, and then all we had to do was race each other, it would be a lot of fun. So, you know, we constantly helped each other out all we could to help raise our bar, you know. And when I joined with Roger, that's basically what it was. You know, he ran it, the team, under the team concept. Everybody worked together, and he understood how that helped the overall, you know, the whole thing. And so I just fit right in, you know, without even knowing. You know, it's just the way he operated, the way I did, you know.
That's something that I appreciate as well, is that you coming in with, I don't want to say no expectations, but, you know, compared to the kids today who seem to come out of the womb with, you know, a karting contract and their whole lives charted out for them to get to the top, I appreciate the fact that you went in not knowing what to expect, not knowing if this was going to be the right fit for you, and soon found, hey, actually, we're, I don't know if you want to say kindred spirits, but we're a group of people that see things the same way, and we can really make the most out of this. I think that's great, not coming in with that expectation right off the bat.
Yeah, that, and then, you know, I didn't, I had to make use of it, you know, because that's job security. You got to put the numbers on the board, because that was the biggest part of the pressure. Roger was great about not putting pressure on me when I came in. You know, he said, hey, you just go out there and get laps, get miles. You need the experience. And he said, I've got Sneva, I've got Mario, and then the next year, whenever, you know, Unser, I got those guys to stand on the gas. You just get the experience. And he was great at taking the pressure off of me. But I think he understood that I didn't, you know, nobody could put any more pressure on me than I put on myself, because I was there to do the best job I could do. And I was wanting to do, you know, yeah, I have my own ego, you know. Okay, yeah, those guys, you know, they're there to stand on the gas. And I want to, but you know what? I want to beat them. You know, that's my job. We're here to try to win races, and to win races, I'm going to have to beat them too, you know. And so that's where the team, being team, sometimes is difficult, because, you know, yeah, you want to work together like my brother and I did all the way up to the green flag drops. But then when the green flag drops, if we run 15th and 16th, I better be 15th.
Wow.
Or if we run first and second, I better be first.
Yeah.
Because that's job security. You know, so your teammate's your yardstick. But then I understand, I realized right off the bat, that's one of the reasons Roger ran it as a team. I mean, there's several reasons. You know, over the years, there's always been people that said, you know, hey, you know, who's number one, who's number two, who's number three, you know. And Roger always said, there is no one, two, or three. And, you know, and nobody would believe him, you know. But if you think about it, the only thing he'd say is, hey, if I'm going to take the time, money, and effort to have three horses in the race, why do I only want one good horse?
Mm.
You know, why am I going to go through all of that and only have one good horse? If he's doing it to raise his odds, to better his odds, you know, he needs three good horses in there. Well, if you think about it, it's pretty common sense. You know, to get the caliber of driver that he wanted to put in the seats, they couldn't, you know, you're going to go to Mario and say, hey, Mario, you got to run number two.
You'd probably,
you know, that's not going to happen.
You'd probably learn some new Italian words if you said that to him.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that was just, you know, to get the caliber of drivers that he wanted for all of his cars, you know, he couldn't really and wouldn't want to do a 1-2-3, you know, because if he did it, if he structured it that way, it would be very difficult to get three good, you know, the high caliber driver that he wanted.
Yeah.
So, and then the other reason is the fact that, you know, which I realized early on with me was a good thing. It kept me digging.
Hmm.
Because it's very, you know, if you're on a one car team, let's say, it's very easy to get a little lax yourself and not even know it. You know, because you're out there digging for fractions. I mean, fractions all the time.
Yeah.
Every corner, every lap, you're trying to improve it. You know, and if there's nobody there to measure off of, you don't have a yardstick, you can get a little lax and not even know it yourself. So I understood that, and that's part of the whole thing. Like coming in, you know, like you said, the kids coming in today. I never had that kind of confidence, which when I look back at it, I think is one of the things that really helped me. I could run 10 races and look down the starting line, and I could have won all 10 of them. And going into the 11th one, all on the same track, and going into the 11th one, I could look down that starting line, and I'd look down that and say, oh, man, one of these guys is going to kick my butt today.
Wow.
I'm going to be on my toes, you know. And I never had that. When somebody'd stand and say, yeah, we're going to win this race, I'd be like, what a fool, you know. If anybody could think that, they have no idea whether they can or not, for sure, really.
Wow.
You know, there's so many variables in this sport between me making a mistake, equipment, you know, the materials that, you know, the guy may have done a perfect job making all the rods in the motor, but the material that somebody else sent him might not be right.
Yeah.
And may you not know it, you know. So how can I be so confident that I'm going to go out and win this race? There's too many variables to be that confident. But I think that kind of mentality for me, it just always kept me digging, you know. And that's where a teammate would come in. Yeah, I'd work with him, and I don't care if you've got the same springs I do, and here's what worked for me, you know, and that's part of the team effort. You work together, this works for me, try it. And if it works for you, good. If it doesn't, then try something else. And then, you know, and you're doing the same with me. So you do that to steepen the learning curve. Everybody has an hour of practice. We have two guys working on it. We can make more ground than one guy.
Wow.
In that hour. And so that was raising the bar. But when that green flag dropped, now he's got the same thing I do. If he beats me, that means I'm leaving some on the table.
Mm. And as I know Roger, he doesn't like anything left. He, no table scraps.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it keeps the drivers honest and keeps them digging. And it's a friendly competition to a point, you know, but it's still competition. I mean, I want to win the race, but if I can't win the race, I at least have to beat my teammates.
Mm. Into that. I guess looking back a little more, maybe anecdotal on your four victories. I guess the last one I'd ask about is 91. With that being, you know, looking at a pretty cool 25-year anniversary of that. But I think your 79 win was fantastic in that it set the table and also told folks that hey, there's the start of something really impressive here. I don't know if folks remember the context so much of your first win, and even getting to number two. I don't know if the 94 win stand. Or I'm sorry, the 84 win stand out as much as they should to some folks. So, just maybe in a general sense, can you share any thoughts or appreciations to the your first two entries in the 500 history books?
Well, you know, it's one thing with age and hitting the fence, the memory's not quite as good as it used to be, but you know, so detail wise it's really difficult, but just the overall pictures, I mean the 79 win, just it happened so quickly for me, you know, in my second attempt, you know, second time to run, and my third time to be there, but second time to run. It happened so quick. great, we won another race. You know, we'd won a few races before that one, and then we ended up winning that. And the first year, we sat on the front row, and, you know, felt like at times we could have had a shot to win that one, the first one. And, you know, but it wasn't to be, and so then turn around and come back next year and win it, sit on the pole and win it. And the pole was almost as exciting as winning the race. It was my first pole. Nobody expected it. I didn't even expect it, you know, and my first pole ever, not just at Indy, but anywhere.
Yeah.
In an Indy car. And so that was huge to me. That was like a win. And I've always loved qualifying at Indy. That's been one of the most pressure-packed, but most fun and most gratifying things to do. And then turn around and win the race. You know, I won the race, but I remember talking to people afterwards and I said, man, what's wrong with you? You ought to be doing double back flips. and I said, well, I am excited about it. First of all, like I said, I didn't appreciate it because I didn't know what it meant to win that race at that point. It was so new to me. I didn't appreciate what Indianapolis was. I didn't know the history. I didn't know how difficult it was.
Yeah.
Which I would learn later with time. And, you know, I mean, obviously I appreciated the win. I was ecstatic about it. But I remember my wife saying, what's wrong? Yeah, I'll be more excited than you are. And this is after, you know, we'd left the truck or whatever. I said, well, I am excited about it, but I didn't win it.
Mm.
And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, Bobby broke before I had a chance to pass him. You know, so I didn't win the race. And I remember I ran into Foyt right after that, at one of the next races. And I was sitting down and talking to him. And I said, AJ, you know, I didn't win that race. I said, you know, and he just starts laughing, you know. And he said, Mears, he said, you know, you take them any way you can get them. He said, you're going to lose more that way than you win.
Mm.
So it all evens out, you know. You won it. And he was right. I mean, I've lost more that way than I've won that way. So, you know, but that's part of the learning and appreciating it more as time goes on, as time went on.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, it makes 79 special. Being the first one makes it special, obviously. Just the things I learned there. And then when you look back at it, you know, the last flat bottom car to win, the way we won it, you know, Roger gave me a choice. We'd built the PC7, and Bobby had done all the development work on the PC7 because, you know, he was the main guy, and I'm still the rookie learning. And of course, Bobby, you know, Bobby was being Bobby. He didn't want me in the car.
No. Now, hold on. Are you saying Bobby is somewhat territorial? No, and wants things for himself?
Oh, nah. I mean, maybe just a touch. I've heard him say, I'm not put on this earth to make Rick Mears go fast. You know. But we laugh about it. I mean, it's out in the open. I'm not saying anything I haven't already said to him.
No. I mean, we all love Uncle Bobby. We also know that, you know, if there was a way where he could have the planet to himself, he would. So
yeah, if he didn't, and I admired the way he looked at it. I mean, I learned. He taught me more than he knows he taught me. You know, and that's what I always say whenever he brings that up in front of a group. You know, I taught me everything. That's my answer. Yeah, he taught me more than he knows he taught me. He taught me how to sort through the BS, how to read between the lines, how to keep my eyes and my mouth shut, my eyes and ears open, and listen. You know, he taught me how to learn. You know, but it's just, you know, so he had done all the development work, and so Roger came to me, and Roger knew that, you know, and Roger came to me and said. He said, hey, it's up to you. He said, you can either, you know, you can either go with a new car, the PC7, you know, for this year, or you can stay with what you know, what you've got the experience in the PC6. And, you know, I think probably personally, he was probably hoping I'd go with the 6 because, you know, the 7 was new. And, you know, and Roger's big on reliability, and that's part of what made Roger. He's understood, and he's like me in that respect. I've I've always known, I learned it in the desert, one of the first things I ever raced. There's only one way to win, and that's to get to the finish.
Yeah, and being stranded in the desert compared to turn three at Indianapolis, that's a lot less pleasant, too. So, yeah, I'm sure that was driven home.
Right. So, you know, it's, and I understood that before I ever got to Indy cars. You know, I there's only one way I can win it. I got to finish it first. That's number one priority, get to the end. And the odds are much better of winning if you get to the end.
Wow.
And so, to me, it's just a simple fact. So, you know, looking back at it, you know, he never said it, but knowing him and the way he is, that way he had a backup. You know, because the 7 was new.
Sure.
We weren't 100% sure about it, and so he was probably keeping his fingers crossed when he gave me that option to take that I would take the 6, and which is what I did. You know, but I did it just because I was comfortable with that car. I knew that car. I didn't know the 7. And as it turned out, we were as quick as Bobby. I mean, there at the end, I was reeling him in, you know, and I felt like I had enough to pass him and get by him and go on. And then he ended up breaking the, you know, fourth gear in the gearbox, so I never got the chance to pass him outright. And so there was a lot of stuff, you know, in that race that, you know, whether it's the qualifying and sitting in the qualifying line, and, you know, Snead was on the pole when he was running for the Sugar Rack team, I think, because Bobby had come on board and Snead was out and I was in full time. And so now here's Snead sitting on the pole, and I'm the last car in line to have a shot at qualifying for the pole. And a couple of cars ahead of me was Foyt. And I remember sitting in the car, sitting there waiting for my turn to go and listening to the PA system, and Foyt's running, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, he's fast first up, oh he's good, you know, whatever lap it was, and then finally he lost the cylinder or something and started losing speed. And I remember now just saying, oh man, it's all over. Mm. It's all over. Sneva's got it. Foyt can't beat him. Sneva's got it. And I'm sitting there thinking, hey guys, I haven't run yet. You know? I'm still here. But it was Rick Hu, you know, I mean, my second year. So it was a big surprise to everybody when we pulled it out. But what I love about that is when you come down pit lane, when I saw a smile on Roger's face, you know, rolling down pit lane after, you know, getting the pole and the team. And to me, qualifying has always been a payback for the team and the hard work they do, you know. And they put in the hours and the effort and the, you know, day and night. And if I can go out there and hang that thing out on the corner, and right corner, and get the pole, you know, that's a thank you to them for all they do to give me the stuff I needed to do it with, you know. So that qualifying along with the race made 79 very special in that respect.
Yeah.
But then they each got more special after that.
Wow.
First one will always have its place because of being the first. You know, and the 84 one, you know, I can't remember a lot of the detail of that race. Well, we ended up with a good lead. Didn't we have a lap lead on the field or something like that?
Yeah, 84? I think that one was a bit of a foregone conclusion.
Yeah. Is 84 or 88 when Sneva was... It was boiling down to he and I to have a battle. I thought he and I were going to have a shootout, and he ended up losing the CV joint.
Yeah.
And I think he and I had almost a lap on the field, or two laps, whatever it was. And then he ended up having a problem, and it was just a matter of us not making a mistake and getting home. So we didn't get to have the shootout. But by then, it had been a few years since the 79, and in that time I'd grown older and wiser, and you know, you run a couple of years, you look around, you don't win it, think, wow, you know, by now you're learning the history of the place and what it all means to the town, to you know, to Speedway, to, you know, the biggest race in the world, and you know what, a lot of guys never get the opportunity to be here.
Yeah. I got one. Now that I know what it means, I'd like another one.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't get the opportunity to even get here And there's a lot of people that have been here that have never won it. And here I've won it once. So, you know, the odds are getting pretty slim of winning it again. Not a lot of people even won it. And then finally you get the second one. And it's, okay, now you go a few more years and it still doesn't happen again. And you think, Jesus, you know, you start looking around. Very few have won it more than twice. So the odds are getting greater against you of winning it again. You know, then that made the third one special. Now the fourth one, you know, you look around, you run a couple more years and you haven't won it. And you look around and say, okay, there's only been two guys that have won it four times.
Yeah, I was going to say.
What are the odds of me doing that?
The talk, it's you funny, know? Yeah. You start, this talk ramps up with each one. You get one, that's fantastic. You're part of the big club. You win two, okay, yeah, that's, hey, there's still, you know, good number of members in that club, but one you definitely check. Three, okay, well, and once you get the three, that there's, I mean, ask Elio. You get the three, and good Lord, every day of your life after you get three is, when are you going to get four?
Well, you're asked constantly about it, and that's the thing you're trying not to do is let that come into play. You know, you're there to win every one of them every year. It's like I tried to go into every year. Like, it didn't matter if I had one or ten. It wouldn't have made any difference. Yeah. That's the first thing from my mind when I'm on the track. And you try to keep it that way. I did anyway. But you're constantly reminded of it. But, you know, that there was something, what was it? There was something there. Just that learning about it and you know, after the third one and realizing, well, also at that point, you're getting further along in your career.
Realize
you don't know how many more years you're going to run,
yeah,
you know, for
the,
sure.
The opportunities are narrowing to make history.
Exactly.
And the odds of making history.
Yeah. So then when we got to, so just that, all of that in itself really made the fourth one even the most special. But then the real kicker that put it over the top as being, you know, of the four, the best, was the fact that of the four, it's the only one that boiled down to the shootout that I'd planned for every year.
Really? I knew about the shootout, obviously, but I didn't know you'd been planning on that.
Well, yeah, that's the way I go into every race. You know, you go in and spend the first half, get to the second half, and working with the car, watching your competitors, seeing who's tough, where they're strong at, where they're weak at. And you start, you know, formulating your game plan, and you start picking out who is going to be the guy you're going to have to deal with at the end, and that's who you're gearing toward throughout the full 500 miles.
And then you're also realizing that by the time you've won two, by the time you've won three, any of the other 32 drivers that are planning their race are probably saying the same thing. All right, who am I going to have to? All right, Mears. All right, well, that's
right.
I'm going to have to game plan against. So that's a lot of folks all kind of aiming at each other for the final showdown.
Yeah, and but then also too, if you're doing your game plan right, they may not be looking at you because you aren't putting all your cards on the table.
Mm.
You know, which is basically what I do. You know, you go through and, you know, all day Michael had everybody covered. He was, you know, at one point he thought he was going to put a lap on me. You ask him today and he'd say, oh, yeah, if I hadn't had a flat tire, I'd have had a lap on Mears. He'd never won that thing. Well, I was watching him. You know, I ran what's necessary. There's only one lap I need to lead. There's only one that I need to lead. And all the other laps are used to be in position to be able to lead that last lap, whatever you have to do to be able to lead that last lap. That's what it's all about. And, yeah, my ego says I'd like to lead them all. You know, that's what my ego tells me. But I've learned years ago in the desert that, yeah, I'd have guys passing. I know I could catch him and blow him off. But probably about 10 miles after I blow him off, I'll break a shock or something that I damaged trying to run that hard to get him back, you know. And I'm planning to get to the end. And sure enough, down the road here, they'd be upside down or in a ditch or broken or something. I'd just drive on by, you know. Okay, the game plan is working. And so I learned that a long time ago. So So I'm watching now. I'm getting splits on Michael where he's at, you know, coming around to put a lap on me. And my car's not right, so I'm not hanging the thing out and taking a chance of hitting the fence and doing something stupid and not get to the end. So I run the pace that's necessary, and as he starts getting closer, I start picking it up a little more and a little more and a little more. And he was coming around, excuse me, to me, but he'd have played hell passing me or catching me completely.
Sure.
And, yeah, because I was just running what was necessary. And until we get to the next stop, make another change on the car and pick it up some more. And so and then he had a flat tire in it. I didn't have to worry about it. Just got to the next stop. But anyway, even after we started getting the car where it needed to be, I didn't want to show Michael what I had. Because, you know, he had a little understeer. And if I have a little understeer in the car, that's the safe way. It might not be quite the quickest, but it's the safest.
Of course. And you can manage that, too, compared to oversteer, exactly. Which tends to manage itself
exactly.
Into the wall.
You've got a little cushion there. If somebody drops well in front of you or somebody does something crazy or whatever, you've got a little cushion to catch yourself. And you aren't just on that little ragged edge. So now if I'm leading and I've got everybody covered, if I've led all day long, like Michael did, and I've had everybody covered all day long, and we come into our last pit stop and I've got a little understeer in the car, you know what? I don't think I'm going to take it out. I'm not going to chance taking it out because I could tip it over real easy.
Sure.
And it, you know, if I try to take that out and I tip it over and the thing goes loose on me, I'll be dead in the water. So I'm going to make sure and just stay where I'm at because I've got everybody covered. No need to. Now, if I don't have everybody covered, I'm going to take that push out, man, because why not? You know, if I can't get them this way, so I've got to roll the dice. And try to make it better after the last stop. So I didn't want Michael to know that he didn't have me covered. So that's why you keep a little up your sleeve.
Nice.
Now after the last stop, okay, showtime, time to go. Now we let him know what we got, you know.
And I think most people that saw those laps can recite them almost verbatim today.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. But it's you know, it just okay, now we do it. And it's just saying, it seems like he and I going back and forth with the pass, you know, on the outside. On the restart he had a run, I had traffic in front of me and it killed my run a little bit. We fanned out three abreast, left a huge hole in there to pull him along. Plus, I know he is quick on restarts. He's fast. He's going to be coming no matter what, and I know that. So when I got held up a little bit on the restart and had to pedal it, through nobody's fault. It was all just a circumstance of timing. Nobody did anything wrong. It was just timing. And as I drafted up to jump out, whoever was in front of me on the restart to go by them, they jumped out to go by who was in front of them, and I had to pedal to keep from hitting them. And then get back after it and go out a third lane. And now we're three abreast, so a huge hole pulling Michael. So we still got momentum to get by the two and to get him down to one. And I see him come and say, okay, he's going by me. And we aren't up to speed yet, so the corners, the groove's a mile wide. So wherever I go, he's going to go the other. So I'll just go to the bottom and let him give him the long way around footage-wise, you know. So he went around me on the outside, which is exactly what I knew he was going to do. And, okay, well, now we're flat, you know, from the start line on. Basically, we're flat. I said, okay, now I got to catch him. And so, you know, I left it flat through two and started picking up his draft down the back chute a little bit. Got it through three and four flat and start picking up his toe down the front chute, and I knew I was going to reel him in at some point, but I didn't think I'd get back to him that quickly,
yeah.
The very next lap. And so when we got down to one, and we had a big run on him, and he knew it, and so he was hesitant. He didn't know whether to go high or go low, and the last second I was standing behind him waiting to see what he was going to do, and he finally just, you know what, I'm going to take the middle. And he stayed in the middle and left the top open. And And I knew he had a little understeer in his car, so I figured he was going to have to go to the bottom to get the push out of it, go to the apron. And that's what I was hoping for, because I needed to get down. I couldn't run around the top all the way around it. I'd lose the front end on the exit. So when I got beside him, and I kept watching him as I was going by him on the outside, and I saw him start for the apron, I thought, oh, great, thank you. I went down with him. And that got me down in the middle of the corner enough that my front end stayed with me while the tires were still semi-cool. And I didn't have to pedal it. I didn't have to lift. And we made it out the other side without having to lift, and got by him by the time we got to the exit of the corner. But, we went back. It was all unknown territory because I'd never done that all day. And went back and looked at telemetry, and that was the fastest I'd been in that corner all day, period. So it was unknown territory, but that's when you do it. That's the time. I'd have never even considered making that move 20 laps into the race.
Sure.
You know, we wouldn't even consider it. You don't roll the dice until you need to. You're rolling as few times as possible. But at that time, it was time. And so that was the shootout. It finally, after all, and like I said, Steve and I thought it was going to boil down to us. He and I having that shootout, in 84, I think it was 84, yep. Not 88.
Yep.
And, but then he had a problem and it didn't materialize. But Michael, he was the guy I was watching all day and thinking, okay, here's our target. And it ended up boiling down to it. And so to be able to finally have the shootout and then come out on top, it was, made it very, very gratifying.
Do you have an appreciation for the fact that, and granted, I realize this probably makes you feel old, and I feel old too, but do you have an appreciation for the fact that, a young Charger today, like a Joseph Newgarden, I think he was born in 91 or something like that. Carlos Munoz, Pagano was probably five or six at the time. It's been 25 years since this great, great final win of yours, but do you have an appreciation for the fact that, amazingly, 25 years have gone by. For those of us who saw it, it's still as fresh as can be, but there's also a whole generation that's come along that, was essentially born maybe even after that took place.
I have to catch myself with the young guys these days. They don't know it. They don't know it unless they've gone back and watched the replays and everything. Because it's part of my job and working with the young guys, with our team, and when we get new drivers in and everything else. And then also I worked for, a few years with IRL and the Lights kids. And I had to remember that they didn't know. And I had to be careful that I didn't get to the point that the older I get, the better I was.
Yeah, back in my day.
I have to check myself once in a while, But, And there's a lot of times a lot of these kids say, oh, yeah, right. Yeah. What's he know? He just fell off the turnip truck. So some kids appreciate it. They understand. Some don't. And the ones that don't, you just got to let them go. So you're trying to help them, but you just got to let it go. And I even check myself once in a while. There's times that, I get to talking to them about different things, and they will almost convince me that it's totally different today than it was then. And then pretty soon something will happen, something we've been talking about, and something they have to deal with, and they come back wide-eyed, like, wow, you were right. That is.
Turn one.
It does.
Turn one
it
was
does
left.
Work that way. Yeah.
It was left when I was there.
Yeah, and it makes me realize that, even though they get me half convinced because they're, oh yeah, what do you know? This is totally different today. It's not totally different. The basics never really change. A lot of the peripheral stuff we do, yes, is totally different. So you've got to boil it down to the basics. When you get banging, you start bringing it right back to the basics. It's all about getting the car balanced, getting all four of those footprints on the ground and working the best they can, try to get that advantage over everybody else, get the car freed up and, trimmed out. And, how we get there is totally different than how we used to get there. But the point we're trying to reach hasn't really changed much. Amen. So, you know, but a lot of the kids don't understand that until something happens to prove it to them. You know, something you've talked about, you know, and then, because you can talk, and I even not just with the big time lapse, but somebody way back then that would come in new when I was driving, when I was current, and you'd go to help them, and it's, because I know I've had people do it to me growing up with things, you know, try to explain something to you, and yeah, I went through it with my kids, you know, my oldest son, and with Casey, and until they experience it, you can talk until you're blue in the face.
Yep.
And explain it all different number of ways. And until they actually experience it and feel what you were talking about, and then the light goes on, you know. And so the ones that are like that, I mean, over the years working with the light kids, you can tell which ones is going in one ear and out the other and which ones are listening, you know. And pretty soon something will happen with the ones that they're letting it go in one ear and out the other, and they come back and say, you know what? Now I get what you were talking about. And it wasn't necessarily because they were listening. They just really didn't understand.
Sure.
You know?
Well, it's the same thing in life. Whether you're in a race car or just, you know, going to school or doing your chores, I mean, whatever it is in life.
Right. It's all relative.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times my father just said, okay, I'm going to stop talking to you because you just are clearly not at a place to understand what, you know, and not that I won't talk to you again, but I'm going to let you go. Basically, you say, I'm going to just go ahead and screw this up. And when you're done with it, then come back to me and we'll talk again. And maybe the things I was just trying to tell you will actually become clear. And I'd get mad and think he was talking down to me, but eventually I'd come crawling back and go, okay, now I get it. So, yeah, it's a life thing.
It is. I had a kid in the lights years ago that, you know, he came out of sprint cars and midgets, and he was a hot shot, you know, and you know, he thought he was just going to come in and blow everybody off, intimidate everybody, and he had it all figured out. And he and I kind of butted heads a little bit early on. I said, okay, I just backed off. Go for it, you know. And he just, you know, every time something would come up, hey, I've raced with Kinzer, I've raced with so-and-so, I've raced with, you know, he just had it all figured out. Okay. And those are the guys that let him go. And one of the first road races we went to, after about two practice sessions, he was dead last. And he was struggling, and he couldn't get going. And so I was walking down pit lane, and like I said, he and I had butted heads, so I just kind of rode him off, you know. And not that I wouldn't help him, but he didn't want help, so fine, I'm not going to help him if he doesn't want it, you know. If he's got it all sorted, he doesn't need any help. And so I'm walking down pit lane, and I look over, and I see him sitting on the wall, and he's just wringing wet. I mean, he is just absolutely soaked. He's busting his butt so hard out there, and he's dead last.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than exhausting yourself and finding out, you know, I could have just stayed in pit lane and had the same result.
Yeah, and I really felt bad for him. You know, and I saw him sitting there, so I just walked over and sat on the wall next to him. He looked over at me and says, you know, I've got a lot to learn.
Wow.
And we both just started laughing, and we've been good friends ever since. You know, because it finally is soaked in that he does have a lot to learn. Wow. You know, and it finally broke him. You know, and he just turned around and says, "You know, you're right." He said, "I've got a lot to learn," and that's what I run into that over the years. I haven't even with the kids, you know, because I did it. I went through it myself. And this is something they don't realize early on. It's something one of those you got to go through. I won some races. I won Indy, and I won some more races. And it was like about the third year. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, I'm starting to get a handle on this. I'm starting to get it figured out. And then I went on down the road, you know, and ran the next year. And I remember sitting down thinking, I remember thinking I was getting a handle on it, and I looked back. I thought, man, when I thought I had a handle on it, I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And I just thought I did.
And then you get a few more years down the road and you go, boy, yeah.
And I went another year and I looked back and because after that first one, I looked back and thought, boy, I didn't know anything, but now I'm starting to get a handle on it. I went another year and looked back and the same thing happened again. Oh, it dawned on me. That never ends.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to say, there comes that point in life for all of us where you eventually realize, I don't know a damn thing, and if I could just stop telling myself I do, I'd really be less disappointed in myself, and I'd be more open-minded.
Yeah, exactly. And it finally dawned on me one time that, hey, and then I realized that if that ever does end, I better get out.
Mm.
Because if that does end, that means I'm not digging. That means the interest isn't there to be looking for the next level. So it's time to go. If I ever go a year and look back and I haven't gained, I better be thinking about packing it in. So, but it's amazing, you know, that you tell kids that today, see, because you'll see them. They'll be going along and they'll be run. And then it's, hey, we got to get the right engineer. You know, we need a better engineer. We need this. We need that. You can't get, you know, they've got their end sorted. They think. They've got it all figured out. Now it's all the car, the equipment, that's the problem, you know, because they know they've got it figured out. And when you tell them something like that, but, hey, you feel like you've got it figured out, but you don't realize you don't. You know, that never stops. And part of making that equipment better is part of your job, helping that engineer and giving them the right tools that they need. I went through with Tracy one time. He, at a practice session, Tracy was just big on carrying the car, you know, and he was 10 tenths, 11 tenths every lap he ran all the time. And finally he came in screaming one day, guys, you got to give me the tools. The car wasn't right. You got to give me the tools. And finally I pulled him aside. I said, Paul, I said, you got to give them the tools. It's not the other way. It's a two-way street. If you don't give them the tools they need, they can't give you the tools you need. I said, you're out there saving your life. And I said, anytime you're qualifying on a lap and you're running 11 tenths, all you're doing is saving your life. You aren't listening to the car. You're too busy saving your life out of every corner to listen to what the car is telling you at once.
Paul was a perfect fit for wealthy team owners. He was never someone destined to drive for a small team with a modest budget and limited spares. And I always loved the fact that whether it was for Haas or Barry Green or Roger, you know, he had a knack. Granted, his talent deserved a big team, but you know, he drove like the budgets were unlimited and the spare parts. You know, Santa Claus was always bringing fresh new spare parts. So that's brilliant.
But the thing was, what he it took him a long time to figure out and understand, because that same day, I think one of the reasons he was you know, screaming at the guys that he needed the tools was because Emerson, the old man, was kicking his butt.
Mm.
You know, and he could not handle that. How can this old man be beating me? Those guys, they can't have, my car must not be right. This old man's beating me. You know, he just couldn't grasp that. And this is, you know, between you and I, but that's when I pulled him aside and said, you got to give them the tools. You got to slow. I said, you don't want to know why the old man's beating you? Yeah. I said, he's building a better mousetrap than you are.
Mm.
That's the only way he's beating you. He's building a better mousetrap. And that's part of what you, if you slow down to 8 tenths, so you're not saving your life every lap, then you can focus on what the car's telling you it needs. Then you can relay that to the team, which is giving them the tools they need, the proper answers, and feedback to be able to give you the tools you need. That's how it works.
And that's how you get the 10 tenths when you need it instead of always...
Then when you run the 10 or 11 tenths, you've got the tools under you to be able to do it.
Wow.
You know, but if you're carrying it every lap and you aren't listening, cars talk to you. That's all. That's like people would say, well, what are you doing in turn one? What do you mean, what am I doing in turn one? I don't know. I go down there and I turn in. As soon as I turn in, the car tells me what to do next. You know, if I'm listening to the car.
Absolutely.
If I'm not listening to it, then I don't know what to do.
Yeah, steering wheel and my butt and a few other things are telling me exactly what needs to happen next.
Yeah, exactly. But so it all goes, you know, together. But that's where, you know, with thinking about 25 years, you know, from that last win, yeah, it's a long time and a lot of things have changed, but a lot of the basics are still very similar, you know. I mean, it's not all exact. Obviously, things change, but it always brought to me when somebody says, you know, basically, like, okay, what's changed since you've been in the car? Because usually that question is asked like, God, it's got to be totally different than when you were there, you know. And the major changes are safety is probably the biggest change. The cars are so much safer than they used to be.
Sure.
And the technology in the tools on how we measure things and the electronics, you know, the data. Those are the two major, major changes. And the electronics and the tools, you know, and how we use them to be able to do what we did anyway, the same, that part hasn't changed. You're still trying to accomplish the same thing. You're just going about it in different ways. So that's where the changes are. Not so much in driving, not so much in what you're trying to achieve with the car. Those basics never really change that much. It's just how you get there and what you use to get there. And the safety are the biggest changes.
Well, that kind of piggybacks on to one of the last two quick questions I wanted to ask, and that's related to other 500 stuff I'm writing. I seem to recall, and please tell me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall reading something quite a while ago about the introduction of, I believe it was Fox shocks, or basically shocks with remote canisters that had basically kind of borrowed from off-road technology and coming into the speedway for the first time. And again, I apologize if I have it wrong, but I just seem to recall that being something that you had either been at the forefront of or otherwise going away from kind of the single tube, if you want to call them, shocks to more modern shocks. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact detail how that came about, but the way it really started, I think, was my brother.
Hmm.
With Ken Anderson and the Fox.
Yeah.
Because you know, we'd been playing with it, and he's the one that was really, you know, utilizing them in off road, and the trucks and different stuff with Ken Anderson, and I think he is the one that kind of brought Ken into the picture, you know, the Fox shocks into the IndyCar arena to start with.
And I remember that being really being the first, call them modern shocks. And it's funny because one of the other things I remember reading was, you know, just anecdotes of how tire engineers from Firestone or Goodyear, whomever, would just, probably more Goodyear than anything at that time, but they'd just be pulling their hair out because, you know, drivers would be saying after 150 miles or towards the end of a stint or whatever it would be that, you know, boy, these tires are really falling off and falling apart. And not that the tires couldn't, but the limited shock technology of the time also contributed, where whether they were overheating or losing some of their efficiency, that, you know, the tire guys are getting all the blame, but in reality, you know, upgrade to canister reservoirs and that kind of stuff really just brought damper technology to a new place, and all of a sudden, real customized handling was, you know, just taken to a really fine art.
Yeah, because that's exactly what was taking place, and we started realizing that, my brother, especially, you know, like I said, with the Fox deal, because we'd already been through that in the desert, you know, 100 miles into the deal, you know, pretty soon you feel like you got no shocks, and, you know, through the rough terrain and everything, and we were putting, had the canisters, and then we started doing and machining cooling fins. We had just boxes of these cooling fins which slide over the canisters for heat sinks.
Wow.
Just to start cooling, you know, the oil in the shocks to keep the temp down on them. because we just, you know, we'd burn the seals out and burn the shafts up, and, you know, and we fought that and fought that and fought that in the desert. That's when, you know, we got together with Fox, and that was a big gain in off-road. And and I'm pretty sure it was my brother that really brought him into the Indy car, and then how we got, I can't remember the detail on how we got involved in it too, but I think my brother started it. And then I don't know if it's just with he and I and our connections and how we ended up, you know, but that is where I think it's fairly correct and where that all started. But it was exactly that. And, cause we had noticed that we'd already been through it in the desert, and then we started realizing it in the cars and in the Indy cars that, you know, on a rough track, you know, things would start giving up, and it wasn't necessarily always the tire. You know, the shock you'd feel, the things just start getting, you know, very loose feeling, not loose in balance, just loose in movement.
Yeah.
You know, you start getting a lot more wheel travel and a lot more uncontrolled spring rate, you know, and it was just shot overheating and going away.
You look at something today where you have, whether it's a cartridge style damper, whether you have the inerters that are, you know, are commonplace. You look at how far things have come. I love looking back at a late 70s, early 80s Indy car and just seeing that single shock, that single coilover shock, that, you know, a Carrera or something else that by modern terms is fairly inelegant. But then you look at what we have today and you say, good Lord, you know, that thing's, strap a couple rockets to it, you can take that to the moon. That's a pretty big piece of technology.
Yeah, they do. And I remember it, in the desert before Fox Shocks, when we went to Bilstein, was in the off road, was one of the first. You know, there was Monroe, and then there was, you know, a couple of, you know, different, you know, shock companies that were. But the desert was just so difficult to get things to live, you know. And I remember the first huge jump in shocks that I remember feeling in off-road was Bilstein when they came on board. And, you know, they'd figured out how to get a lot of control with a light nose pressure for the small Ripley stuff, and so it wasn't shaking your teeth out. You can keep the tire on the ground for grip and traction and braking, and yet still have control over the big stuff.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, and live. They were a lot longer shock, and boy, they had to be mounted perfect. You'd collapse you'd bend the shaft because they were small shafted, so it didn't displace as much oil and all that. And but you could fold them up pretty easy if you didn't have them mounted just perfect, you know, to get all that travel. And but they worked great, and that was kind of one of the first big steps in the off-road. And then Fox came along, and then they started doing the external canisters, and we really started realizing the heat. Bilsteins, we were running the heat sinks over the Bilstein shocks to cool them. That's when we started all that, was on the Bilstein. And then later Fox came on board, and then the external canisters, and, you know, other ways of cooling it and having the reservoir and everything else. And then you go back to bigger shafts and displace more oil, and yeah, just a lot of different combinations of stuff. But it was a ever changing deal going on. But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure my brother was the first one to really get the Fox Shocks on an Indy car.
Wow. The last question I had for you, and it's kind of sticking to the technology theme, was, and I must admit, I don't know the exact start date, but when do you remember at Indianapolis where onboard computers started to become, I guess, first introduction maybe, and then when those started to become, you know, kind of part and parcel of doing business? Today, you know, it almost seems like, good Lord, without a computer on the car, people wouldn't know how to drive or engineer. But do you remember when they first started coming in and becoming part of, you know, the must-have technology?
I don't remember what year it was, but, you know, I remember when we first started putting the sensors on the cars to read the stuff, and it was like, wow, this is cool, you know, and we, I think at that time we measured three things, you know, one was steering angle, one was throttle position, and one was speed.
Yeah.
And I think that was when we started, that was the only three things we measured. Because I remember, you know, I knew nothing about computers. I couldn't even turn one on. and we started doing that, and I started looking at those graphs. I'm thinking, wow, there's something to this, you know. And so I was probably one of the first drivers. I said, I've got to look at this. Yeah, and I wanted to, you know, that's when computers or laptops had just started to come out, and I kind of wanted to play with it. You know, it was interesting, even if I didn't have a clue. So I said, guys, I'm gonna go buy a laptop. This is at Indy.
Wow.
And I said, I'm gonna go buy a laptop, and then you guys can download stuff or whatever and show me how to plug it in, and so I can take it to the hotel with me at night and look at it. So I went all over and called all over and went all over Indianapolis trying to find a laptop. This is how early it was.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak ill of our friends in Indianapolis, but when I'm thinking laptops in the mid-1980s, Indy probably isn't the first location that comes to mind.
Right. I finally found one, I think it was a compact. I finally found one, and it was expensive as all get out, you know. I mean, at that time, a laptop was just out of this world, you know. And I bought one, and I took it back to the hotel, and got it all set up, and so at the end of the day, I don't remember now if it was Gibbons or who it was, and who, at the time we were starting all this, but they would collect the data and then put it on a floppy drive. On a floppy, and when I'd get ready to go to the hotel, they'd hand me the floppy with a stick-it note on there, a little post-it note, that said, okay, turn the computer on, plug this in, hit this key, hit that key, hit this key, and this screen should come up, and then you hit that, and you know, to tell me how to get it up and running. And then that's what I did. I'd go to the hotel room, plug it in, and then I could look at, you know, I'd look at my teammate's steering angle and throttle angle and speed in the corner. And, you know, and if they had more straight line speed than me, let's say I had a better lap time, but they had more straight line speed than me. Okay. They had a better valve. They had a better pop off valve.
Yep.
So then we'd get down and look at the corner, and I'd look at the steering angles. I said, okay, the way I'm beating them is I've got less steering angle in the car. I've got the thing on the right rear more. It's freer through the corner, and my speeds would come back up in the corner. It wouldn't drop off as much as theirs did. And that's how, you know, I started figuring out, you know, the balance of the car, and, okay, right rear is fast, you know.
What?
Because they're going into the corner quicker, and they've got a better valve. Okay, the only way I can beat them is I've got to get it through the corner faster because they've got more power than I do down straightaway, or vice versa, you know, whatever it might be. So I remember that's when it all started. And that was such one of the big learning curves when all of that started. Like I said, we collected three channels. And then they start adding, they start measuring this, measuring that. And I remember it was such a huge part of the learning curve for the team and the engineers. Okay, all of a sudden we've learned how to collect all this data. Now the next big learning curve was how do we utilize it?
I was going to say, what do we do with all this stuff?
Exactly. Now what do we do with it? And I remember that being a huge learning curve for the team. You know, now we've got all this data. How do we utilize it and make it work for us? You know, so then learning how to, that goes right along with the line of, you know, at a stage, I remember at one point throughout those years, you know, all part of this learning curve is we got more and more engineers involved, and how do you raise the bar? How do you improve? That's what this game's all about, period, is improving everything all the time. And, you know, we'd need a backup car all of a sudden. You get a backup car out, and get it out there and get it on the track. And, you know, you're short on time, you're in a hurry, and the car's totally different feeling and balance and handling than the one you just got out of, you know. And so we start realizing that, you know, we had to get all the teams on the same page, because every chief mechanic, and he measured from one side of the line, the other chief mechanic measured from the other side of the line. And he taught his guys differently than this other team did.
Wow.
You know? So, okay, we got to standardize this across the board. We got to figure out how to get these backup cars to come out of the trailer like the other cars. And that was all a matter of getting all your teams all on the same page and teaching all of them how to measure on the same side of the lines. And everybody do the, you know, standardize everything. And that was a big, huge step in performance, you know. And everybody was doing it, it's just who does it first.
It's a tool, you know, it's then, a tool then, that, then, you know, yeah, you can figure out better than the others, or the others can fare better and get more from it. So that was, there's a competition there, too.
Yeah, and, you know, you got to be the first to come up with the new ideas of how to improve it, you know. And then pretty soon everybody else is going to catch on and do the same thing anyway. So, but by then, you need to be looking ahead at the next thing you've got, to, next level you got to go to. You know, how are we going to improve on this now? So that's an ongoing, whether it's in tools, whether it's in how you utilize the tools. But that was the huge step in electronics, you know, and collecting the data and then learning how to utilize the data. And how do we collect more now that we're figuring out how to use it, you know?
Three channels. What's the next, how about 20?
What's the next channel that we need to go that would be a benefit to the ones we have, that we can utilize and bring into the ones we already have, that would help us, you know, in some other areas. And so that was an ongoing process, and it's ongoing today, you know.
I don't know if you wear a Fitbit, but those have become fairly popular today, where people can, you know, monitor and then download and review how many steps they've taken, their heartbeat, graph throughout the day, etc. But, you know, people in their daily lives can, you know, essentially have their own personal data recorders that monitors, you know, their physical attributes throughout the day. So I think that's become just part of normal life. What was it like for you for many years, being essentially your own data recorder, having to give feedback, to then all of a sudden having a graph printed out in front of you that quantifies you, where you can actually now see a computer representation of what you did and how that compared? Was, I have to imagine that was a pretty mind-blowing experience for, in terms of firsts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, there was no more lying. I mean, that was the first thing, you know, when as soon as they started measuring throttle, you couldn't say, hey, I was flat down there. They'd look at it and say, no, you weren't. Well, yeah, I was. No, you weren't. Well, I thought I was. Well, you weren't. You know, so now it's all on the table. You know, you can't get away with anything. They can see it all. And just like crashing on TV, you know, everybody saw what happened. Why are you going to get out of the car and say you didn't do it? It wasn't my fault. Yes, it was. All you just watch the replay.
They're currently sweeping up your reputation. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it was good. But in the physical part of it, you know, the fitness part of it, I never did any of that. I mean, there were at times they wanted to put heart monitors on the mower run. I said, I don't want to know. No, I'm not doing it. And you know, as far as staying fit, I never had to work at it until after my accident in 84. And because I was active. I mean, when I got out of a desert car, a three-hour stint in an Indy car was a piece of cake.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I was used to 8, 10, 12, 14 hours of focus and concentration. So 3 hours was a no-brainer to me. And which is one of the things I think it really helped me, because I could stay focused from start to end. And physically, it was the same thing. You know, and I was used to beating my tail off. And these things were on smooth road, no dirt in your eyes, no bumps beating you up, and in comparison, you know. And I was always at, you know, riding motorcycles in the desert and, you know, water skiing, whatever. I was pretty physical anyway. So I never did really, and I hated working out anyway. And I did a little from time to time. I'd work on weak, my neck was weak before we started using restraints on the helmet and all that kind of thing. You know, I work on the neck muscles to, you know, any place I felt was weak that I needed help, I'd work on, you know. But I kind of did it as needed. And then after my accident, when I was laid up, two things, you know, being laid up and age, to get back to where I needed to be, then I had to work at it.
Sure.
And I had to catch up, you know, and so then I got more into the physical routine and you know, did the things necessary to do it, to get back where I needed to be. And I'll never forget when I realized I was caught up. I don't remember what race it was, but it was one of the physical tracks, you know, a hot day or whatever. And all of a sudden, I'm coming down the straight, and they say, 5 laps to go. And I go, what? 5 laps to go. You're kidding me. No. I mean, I knew I'd caught up because up to that point, it was me on the radio saying, how many laps to go?
You sure? You just tell them, we've done enough. We're good.
Yeah. How many laps do we have? 20? Oh, you gotta be kidding me. You know, and then all of a sudden, I'm at the end of the race and don't even know it, you know. I'm finally getting caught up here. But, so, you know, that, and I've always been big on, I mean, I'm lazy. Let's put, you know, on the table, I'm lazy. I've been lazy all my life. That's why I chose a job sitting down. But I always felt like, you know, my body tells me what it needs if I listen to it. You know, it tells me what to eat, you know, and if I need salad, I crave a little salad, and then I have my salads for a while, and pretty soon I got to chew on something, you know. My body tells me it needs to chew on something. I need something a little heavier, you know. And I've always been a believer in that. You know, if you listen to it's like listening to a race car. It tells you what it wants if you listen to it. But I tell you, when I did get out of the car, and that was part of the decision. The desire was going away was the key. That was the main thing. The desire was tapering off, and I noticed it one time. It was at Indy. I was always big on the setup of the car working. I enjoyed that, you know, working with the guys and figuring out building better mousetrap. How are we going to build a better mousetrap? That was always one of the real interesting parts to me, the fun part. And I always took it home with me. I'd come back in the next day into the garage and say, hey, guys, last night I was thinking about it. We need to take a look at trying this, 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 or this. And that was just routine. You know, that was just normal. And I remember at Indy one time, I went to the hotel one night, and we went to a function or whatever and went back to the room. I went back to the garage the next day. I remember I walked in the door. Sorry, guys, where are we at? What are we doing?
Interesting.
And I go, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't bring anything to the party. Oh, interest is tapering off. The desire. And that was the very first indicator that came to light to me. And I always swore that, you know, and I knew that would happen one day. The desire would start tapering off. And I'd always told myself, when that starts happening, it's time to go, because this business is about improving every corner, every lap. And if you aren't going up, there's no such thing as leveling off. If you aren't going up, you're going down. And I knew once the desire would taper off, the performance would go with it. And if the performance started going off, it wouldn't be any fun, because the fun part was competing.
Sure.
So, and it wouldn't be fair to the team if you aren't willing to dig and get that extra bit that you need, you know. And you always work harder at something you enjoy and what you love doing than otherwise. So I knew once the desire started tapering off, it would be time to go. So that was the first thing that started happening.
I realized
that was start. I'm sorry?
Reflecting on that, did you notice your competitive desire was diminishing, or did you feel that you'd reached a point in your life where the desire for change, you've been doing this thing for many, many years, successful at it, but maybe I crave a change of pace in life. I'm just curious if your racing desire diminished, or if your desire to go do something other than drive is what you felt.
No, there was no desire to do anything else. It was just, I knew that, I mean, I still love doing it, but I knew the desire was starting to taper off to where I wasn't going to dig as deep.
Mm.
You know, like having that teammate there to as your yardstick to push. And, you know, that teammate is what helps keep you digging, just like the desire, and the desire to beat that teammate is what helps keep you digging and trying to find more and new and improve and another step, another level. And I just knew when that started taking place, I wouldn't be digging as deep. And I wouldn't be as, and to me, it's like, it depends on the individual. It's always different. It's like Mario. You know, Mario was running strong when I started. He was real strong, still running strong when I quit. And I always admire, it's about keeping the fire lit. And I always admired how Mario could keep that fire lit as long as he did, that desire to do it. And, you know, because once the fire starts going out, that desire starts tapering off, you aren't going to do the job. But I could still have some desire. The way I looked at it was different. Mario, I heard him say one day, when at one point when everybody, all the media started asking, when are you going to retire? When are you going to retire? That, you know, all that started. And I remember his response one day, and I didn't agree with it. I was the opposite. I heard him say, you know, they asked him that question. He said, well, he says, you know, he says, I realize that I might not be quite as competitive as I once was, but I still feel I'm competitive enough to win a race. And I heard him say that. I thought, yeah, I understand it. I 100% understand what he's saying, but I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
For me. Because to me, it was all about how do I get better than I was the time before. You know, it's like tires. Here's an example. Tires go off, right?
Sure.
And I've got a stint that I run. When I go out, I make a lap. When I go through, I qualify in Indy. When I go through the turn one at the green, I log what took place, what the car told me. And I analyze that, what I need to do next time through to improve it. Do I lift earlier? Do I lift later? Do I turn in later? Do I turn in earlier? What, you know, whatever the car did, now I'm going to make a correction next time through there to make that better. So I log it as I go through one. I go through two, whatever the car does there, I log that. I go through three and I log that. I go through four and I log that. I get back to one again. Okay, I'm back to what I logged in one. And what I knew I was going to have to do to make it better this time through, but I also had to figure in what I felt in 2, 3, and 4 with the tires going off, and figure that into the equation in turn one this time.
Yeah, definitely.
To improve it. And then the same process happens over again for the next lap. Same process again for the third, same process for the fourth. So I'm improving each corner every time I go through it. Okay, well now tires go off. And let's say for the stint of a race, a tire is going to lose, let's say, a second. Okay, so every lap I'm going to be going a little slower and a little slower and a little slower. How do I improve if that's happening? The way I improve is that I go off less than everybody else.
Brilliant.
That's how I improve. My numbers are going down, but if I can make mine go down less than the other guys, that the tires are going off the same way, then I've improved better than they have. So it's all about improving. So that's why I didn't agree with Mario. You know, to me, yeah, I'm still competitive. I still enjoy it. but I know the desire is starting to taper off to where I'm not going to dig deep enough to improve. So, yeah, I could probably still win some races, but I'm not as good as I was. And to me, the fun part was being able to go down and put a lap together or a corner together better than I had before. Go to another level. So, you know, when that time came and I started realizing that was taking place, yeah, we were still, you know, we could still run well, but I knew it wasn't going to be long and it was going to start dropping off more. And I thought, you know, and then I woke up one morning and thought, you idiot. What the hell are you doing? If you're thinking about it, it's already time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very simple. If you're thinking about it, it's paying your past due.
It's not a big coast down period on that decision. It's either no. There, whether you recognize it or not, it's been made.
Yeah.
I've never really understood farewell tours. Granted, I understand them from a fan standpoint because, you know, whatever sport, yeah. Kobe Bryant's doing it right now where, you know, Kobe is nothing like who he was when he was, you know, the best in the game. He's giving fans a chance. Green is also making, I think, $20 million a year, so that's not a bad motivation. But he's giving fans a chance to say goodbye. But at the same time, I'm not a big fan of nostalgia acts. And this is maybe off the beaten path a little bit, but my wife says, hey, this band's coming to town that, you know, I know you love them in the 80s. Do you want to go see them? I say no every time because I know I'm not getting that energy, that vitality, that whatever that band was when they were young and at their peak.
Right.
I don't want to see, you know, I don't want to see guys 40 years older phoning it in. And I'm not saying that's what every farewell tour is, but it's a dynamic sport we work in. And if you can't see all those dynamics, to me, I'd almost rather not see it.
Yeah. And that's the way with me. I remember watching guys run or play or whatever sport or whatever go too long. And I thought, I don't want to look like that. I'd rather remember that guy when I think about him being on top. Not think about him where he is now. You know, if I don't see where, you know, if I hadn't seen where he is now, I'd still be just thinking about him the way he was instead of the way he is. You know, and that's just the way, to me, I didn't want to go that long to where that really took place. But then the farewell tour stuff, I mean, there was no way. I mean, I'm not superstitious, but why take a chance?
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way I always looked at it. No. Somebody say, you superstitious? No. You don't have any socks or any superstitions or anything? No. But I don't like green. I don't put my helmet upside down in the seat. I don't do this. I don't do that. But I'm not superstitious. I just don't like to take a chance.
Yep. That's
you know?
Great.
Well, that's like, don't tell me when the last run of the day is at a test. Because that's when something happens. It's always on the last run, you know. Just send me out for the last run, and when I come in, say, okay, we're done, get out.
I love it.
Don't tell me this is going to be our last run of the day. You know, I'm not superstitious, but why take a chance?
Absolutely.
And the whole swan song year is last. Oh, this is going to be your last time at this track. It's going to be your last race. It's going to be your last whatever. I don't want to hear it. that's not all of it. It was time to go.
I understand.
It was time to go. It's time to go, period. And I have no regrets. No second. There's never been any time. Somebody say, do you ever want to get back in the car? And I said, well, or do you miss it, you know, over the years? Well, yeah, you'll always miss it. I miss being able to ride a motorcycle through the desert up on my tiptoes on the rear wheel and, you know, over stuff. But I can't do that. I'd love to do it, but I can't. I know I can't. And the same way with getting back in a car. You know, I never understood how somebody could run Indy only because I felt like it took all year after Indy the year before and everything leading up to it to be current enough to do the job I needed to do that I'm trying to improve on. You know, and so by the time I was out of the car a couple of years, could we have gotten back in and could we have gotten back up to speed? Yeah, to a point. But I know I would never be able to get back to where I thought the real fun was. And that's laying down a lap and getting through a corner that nobody else had done. And that's getting it on the right rear as far as it'll go and without it getting away from me and as far as I've ever had it out there. You know I can't do that, and that's the fun part. I don't care how many laps I would, you know, 5 years after I was out of the car, I don't care how many laps I would run. Could we get to a point of being decent? Yeah, probably could. But I could never get to the point that I was once at.
I guess if you're looking at legacies, you have your own behind the wheel, and also whether it's an Elio or a whomever, that or even drivers outside of Penske who've really become some of the best at what they do because they've had a not too bad of a coach.
Well, thank you. And that's fun. And that's the part. I still enjoyed that part because you still feel like you're contributing. And you're trying to help build a better mousetrap because I enjoyed that part of it as far as working with the engineers and the drivers and the setup. Whatever, because I appreciated the help, all the help I got. I know how much it helped me, and it's fun to have a young kid, and like I said, when they go out and do something, and you see the light bulb come on, and it clicked. You know, it made sense. It fell in place. Oh, I know what you were talking about. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, that works. You know, it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling, and it's enjoyable to see that. See that take place in whatever it is, whether it's driving the car, whether it's over the years, it's been a lot of things. You know, we get a young kid that's, you know, that maybe hasn't worked with the team structure, the team concept, doesn't understand how it works. You know, how to apply those things and how to get the benefit of it. They haven't worked with sponsors. You know, or they haven't worked with promoters, or they haven't, you know, the media, whatever it might be, you know, not just driving the car, but all of the aspects. That's kind of my job description is whatever's needed, you know. It's whatever we can help with because it's been different over the years. When Will came on board, he had a lot of road course experience, but not a lot of oval experience.
Sure.
So that's what I worked on mostly with him, was to help steepen the learning curve on the oval stuff. We get a driver in that comes from another team that has a different language. They're saying the same thing, but they're saying it in a different language, not in type of language, but just using different terms, different words. And being a driver, they can sit down with our engineer. You always hear about teams gelling. You know, it takes time for a team to gel. You know, you almost become an interpreter. The driver sits down and says, okay, we're here in turn three. The car was doing this and doing this and doing this, but he's saying it in things that our engineers haven't heard, using terms that they haven't heard, because that's what he used at the other team. And I know what he's talking about because I've been through that corner. I know what he's saying, what the car's doing. So I say, oh, you mean it's doing this, this, and this? Yeah, that's it. Okay, now my engineers know what he's talking about. So I can help the gelling process, you know, speed that up a little bit at times. So it's just kind of keeping the eyes and ears open and as to whatever's needed. Sometimes it's wearing a, you know, putting on the striped referee shirt between teammates, you know, whatever it might be. But that's what excuse me, has kept it fun for me too, because that's what I always enjoyed about the racing. I'm one that gets bored fairly quick with things, and the racing has held my interest as long as anything, and it's because it's always different. Like, well, I said, you could win 10 races against the same guys at the same track, and it would have been a different route and a different competitor on a different day to get to that same win. It was always different. The track's always different. The conditions are always different. No two laps are ever the same. And that's what has always been the interest. And that's the same way with, you know, what I do now. It changes.
Rick, thank you.
It's whatever I need at the time.
Well, no, thank you. I mean, it's been It's been incredible to see the influence you've had over, you know, your entire career. Like I said, in the cockpit, outside of the cockpit, it's been one of the great gifts to motor racing. So, thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
And that was Rick Mears. Hope you pardon the bit of hero worship at the end, but look, I may do this for a living, but these guys are still heroes and have been and were heroes long before it became a profession. Thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallpruitt.com.